From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour goes back to 1938 in Vienna, Austria. A pediatrician and medical theorist was giving a lecture about child psychology, and he used the term autistic. His work seemed to break new ground for researchers to come, but it wasn't until 1981 that this pediatrician's work became more widely understood. You might even know his name, Dr. Hans Asperger. From that first lecture in 1938 to the present day, there have been advances and setbacks in understanding the spectrum of autism disorders, and the debate is intense and emotional when it comes to what we should expect socially from people with autism. Dr. Lawrence Sugarman has worked in primary care for 30 years, and he's developed a new method. It includes hypnosis and biofeedback, and this hour on Connections, he will explain exactly what that means. Whatever your initial reaction to the word hypnosis, keep in mind that Dr. Sugarman teaches pediatric hypnosis workshops around the world, recently presenting in Oslo, Norway, and Heidelberg, Germany. His approach to autism is impacting families in the Rochester area now. We're going to hear from some of those families later this hour. First, we welcome RIT's Dr. Lawrence Sugarman. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan. I'm glad to be here. And I'm a supporter, so this is a very appropriate.
I fundamentally reject the idea that people don't want depth in news and broadcasting. And this is where it happens. And let's be honest, Dr. Sugarman, what you're working on, and this field in general, it's hard to sum it up in a 90-second news broadcast. That doesn't denigrate the work that's being done elsewhere. But boy, there's a lot to get to, isn't there?
That's right. That's right. And there's a lot of misunderstanding from sound bites. So having the opportunity to speak in depth, to field questions, to share exciting work, only happens this kind of format.
Well, let's get into it here. And again, if you're just joining us here on Connections on this Wednesday afternoon, Dr. Lawrence Sugarman has worked in primary care for 30 years. And like all of us, we've seen an evolution in diagnosis with autism, now roughly considered 1 in 88. And so now we're talking about hypnosis and biofeedback. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour here, some people might have a certain reaction to hypnosis. Others might have another reaction. Let's start by defining what that is.
Right. So let me take a step back, which is that to say that I went into primary care pediatric practice with no understanding of these ideas. But very quickly in starting doing primary care in the Rochester community, it felt like something was missing. I knew a lot of things from excellent training at the University of Rochester and their pediatric residency program about how to do things to kids. And most of our healthcare is about doing things to people, using medication, using surgery, manipulation, et cetera. But behavior change, how we change ourselves, how we act in healthy ways, involves developing our own skills. So hypnosis and biofeedback became areas of study for me in primary care as ways to help children help themselves. And it seems to me, and it has always seemed to me, that that's the most powerful investment we can make in our health. So both of these are skill sets. They're groups of understanding how to do things, just like other doctors can learn how to use a stethoscope or look in somebody's ear or interpret laboratory results. These are fundamental skill sets, however, because hypnosis is about how we use our language, how we respond to people's states of awareness, how we use our understanding of communication with others to affect change, to affect real change in their abilities. Now, of course, hypnosis can be used to sell cars and to negatively influence people. Hypnotic types of techniques are used in cults in destructive ways. We're not talking about that. And so can medication and surgery be used in negative ways. However, you could argue that the fundamental skill set in health and care, is how we communicate. So clinical hypnosis is a 250-year-old skill set in intercommunication that promotes healthy behavior. Biofeedback is what happens when you get to see the physiological, the biological behavior that you're generating come back to you on a screen. Put simply, it's a mirror. When you look in a mirror, that's not how you look, because you know you're looking in a mirror and you change your facial expression. So if I got to show you your breathing on a screen as a graph going up and down, or a bar graph going up and down, or changing scene in a meadow, or any kind of graphic display on a computer, seeing your own breathing and realizing you're generating that will change your breathing. We can show people their breathing, how their heart rate changes, how their sweat glands and their fingers change, which really responds quickly to stress level. There are other types of biofeedback, how people relax muscles, nerve activity. We primarily focus on breathing, heart rate, and skin temperature and skin conductance, the electricity in our sweat glands, because then young people with whom we work can see how their thinking and feeling affects their body.
I think of it this way. I think for years when we talked about smokers and we talked about, boy, if you could only see your lungs, and all of a sudden you started showing pictures of lungs of smokers, 40-year smokers. I remember some of my own family members. They had a chance to see those images and they thought, well, I have to do something now. Right. It was kind of a form of biofeedback. And what you're trying to do is let people see the process, or see what the way our bodies are reacting to certain stimulus or certain activity.
And then linking that. So when they see those pictures of their lungs, or even in real time saw lung function somehow, the hypnotic piece is linking that to images and experiences for behavioral change, to be able to say, okay, I want to feel or see myself moving in a better direction.
So we have children with a diagnosis of autism. And again, I want to stress an important point here that Dr. Sugarman stressed to me before this hour began, which is that there are a range of doctors and researchers, both locally and around the country, who are pioneering new efforts and approaches to autism. And your work, as much as the attention it's getting, and for good reason, is not to denigrate other approaches. You don't use medication on this approach. That doesn't denigrate others who do. But this is just a different way, and for a lot of us, a new way of thinking about this issue. So let's kind of go through this process. You have a child with a diagnosis of autism, which probably deserves its own definition. A brief definition of autism?
So autism is called a neurodevelopmental disorder, meaning somehow your nerves develop in different ways. That is classically defined as having problems in three areas. One, some kind of problem with talking, with language, some kind of problem with understanding social cues and interacting with other people, and some kind of problem with being flexible in your thinking, having narrow areas of interest, or needing to do the same things over and over again and being kind of rigid in that way. And those three things come together. The new term as of May 2013 is autism spectrum disorder singular. So Asperger is part of that. All sorts of other labels that have come along are part of this big umbrella of autism spectrum disorder. That's how I'm going to use it, because that's the official language.
Okay.
But there's controversy about that.
Okay. But one part that I think we can agree on, and that you've written about, is that there is, and this, every person is different, and every person with a diagnosis of autism is different. But fight or flight is kind of a way of offhandedly describing a feeling of discomfort, tension, and it can be more acute and prolonged in people with cases of autism. Tell me why that's so important.
So that's important for two reasons. First of all, that classical definition kind of ignores the fact that while not everybody has all those things with autism, the joke is, if you've met one kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism.
That's right.
So it's such a wonderful, diverse group of people that they don't all share all those impairments, but the research, the literature, and certainly our experience confirms that nearly 100% of people with autism have that uncomfortable high stress level all of the time. And then the question becomes, is that because they have difficulty, or is it underlying that difficulty? And that's an interesting question, because if it's because they have problems with language or understanding people or changing their minds, then when everything's going fine, that stress level should go down. And the evidence is that that's not true. So if the stress level doesn't go down when everything's wonderful, then maybe it's there all of the time. That's important because we are testing the possibility that teaching kids with autism to self-regulate their stress using hypnosis and biofeedback might change all of the rest. It might allow them to socially interact better. It may allow them to change language. It certainly is likely to allow them to decrease that rigid behavior that I think, and I think the evidence supports, is a compensation, is a way of coping. So paying attention to twirling things or rocking or being very interested in Legos or Thomas the Tank or quantum mechanics or computer diagnostics or whatever it is, that those areas of heightened area of interest may be kind of a way to be compensate for the stress, and therefore we have people who are more adaptable and flexible, most importantly, feel better by learning these skills.
Yeah, you're taking, as you described, the fact that if you've met one kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism, that's one of the great challenges for the medical community, because
right.
It is not like treating so many other issues out there. But you're tackling maybe the one part that's the most common or uniform. And again, you're doing it with biofeedback and hypnosis and helping, we say kids, starting at what age?
Oh, 4 or 5.
Okay. Helping kids start to understand their own selves better and how to cope. So take us through the process. If a family comes to you, and you started in the fall, we're starting to see more results now.
Mm-hmm.
When families come to you, they say, okay, I've got a child who's 8, diagnosis of autism. What's the process?
Well, I'll take you through the process. I want to add a caveat, a warning. One is that in clinical practice, we can do whatever seems to work right. In research, we're doing one thing, and the research we're doing at Rochester Institute of Technology involves testing some specific kinds of biofeedback to find out what works the best. So as a more general clinical approach, I think there are two ways to look at this. We go in two different doors into the same room. And one is to take that what's called a restrictive repetitive behavior. That's that rigid thing. Let's imagine in our paper, we imagined a kid who really likes paying attention to railroads and only wants to talk about railroads. So imagine that interest in railroads is, here comes the hypnosis word, is trance-like. I feel best. I feel in control. I feel competent. I feel good when I'm thinking about railroads. Can we talk about railroads? And the clinician says, yes, we can. Mm-hmm. So we help that young person, depending on their developmental ability, usually the ability to talk, to notice that they can feel like they're thinking about railroads all of the time, even if they're not actually talking about it. So it gives them a sense of competence. That's kind of a top-down approach, a thinking approach. At the same time, or at another visit, we hook them up to sensors, the sensors I've mentioned before, skin conductance, sweat gland activity, how the heart changes with breathing, and temperature of the skin, because our hands get cold when we're scared and they warm up when we're comfortable. And we can present that to them. This is what we're testing at RIT in lots of interesting ways. So they see that on the computer screen and they learn how to increase their comfort. We like to talk about increasing comfort rather than decreasing stress. So we can do both those things at the same time. We can increase comfort with how we breathe and how we relax our body, and I can be imagining railroads in the back of my mind when I'm in uncomfortable social situations and when I'm being called on in class and when I have to make a transition at home. I can learn these skills to help myself. And the more you practice, the better you get at it.
If I could jump in here, in reading the work that you've done, this is where you take that phrase, symptom into strength.
Yes.
If it's a symptom that you are somewhat obsessive with railroads or you're really locked into mathematics or whatever it is, instead of viewing it as a symptom, you start to use it as a strength to mitigate stress in other situations.
Right. So that the paper we're referring to that has one of those titles with the colon in the middle, but the part before the colon is, I like those titles, is Symptoms as Solutions. I didn't make that up. That comes from a wonderful psychiatrist, Milton Erickson. And so let me rephrase what you said, which is that if you imagine the symptom, I'll speak firsthand as if I'm a person with autism mm-hmm. or any other problem. If you imagine my symptom as my resource, as my best ability to cope, that's something I do really well. I'm really good at thinking about railroads or knowing movie titles, or that's something that gives me comfort. So that's the beginning of the solution. So one of the most important implications, one of the most important lessons of this kind of approach is to look at young people, not just with autism spectrum disorder, but any developmental difference. Mm-hmm. My favorite word is developmental disability. As resourceful. They already know a lot more than I do about how to cope. I get to, as the clinician, get to steer that coping in useful directions. In other words, they already know a lot about how to help themselves. I get them to adapt that in ways that help them be even more comfortable.
It's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're spending the hour with Dr. Lawrence Sugarman of RIT, who has spent 30 years in primary care and is also a truly worldwide and foremost expert on hypnotism. And that is a question that now, here's the part that I want to make sure our audience understands. You are looking at, you're trying to help with biofeedback. You're trying to help kids and families, because it's not just helping children and families, right. It's helping entire families.
Right.
But why and where does hypnosis come into that process?
So it's a great question. And, you know, since the beginning of that term being coined, that word hypnosis being coined in the 1850s by a surgeon named James Braid, it's been misunderstood and misused, with all great respect to WXXI, by the media,
the literature. I have no doubt.
And there are people in Las Vegas who make their living, quote, being a hypnotist. I'm going to say hypnotist, hypnotize, and those are two terms we don't use in clinical settings. And hypnotism, which sounds like a religion of some sort, mm-hmm. is another term we don't use. It's a skill set. So hypnosis is how I get to help that boy who loves railroads imagine, experience being on a railroad in the back of his mind and bring that back to mind whenever there's a stress, whenever there's a challenge for him, something that used to make it hard. In the back of his mind, maybe he hears the ringing of a bell on a train. Maybe he hears the train. He doesn't have to express that to anybody. It's private, but it gives him a sense of control. How we evoke each young person's ability to help themselves, and of course kids do this better because they live in the world of imagination, is a powerful tool. I'll say one last thing about that. I have colleagues around the world who have done long-term research with kids who have problems like recurrent headaches and recurrent other problems, irritable bowel syndrome, showing that when you teach children these skills early, they become different kinds of grown-ups.
I don't say this flippantly. I say that this is the modern version of Pavlov's dog, right?
I mean, this is
conditioning a response. But what's the process of the I'm not going to say hypnotizing, right. Of the hypnosis.
Right. So there's no one single answer. And what I teach, have the pleasure of teaching to clinicians around the world is how to respond to the child's suggestions about that, the child's clues about that. So it can look like, listen to my voice, relax in a chair, pay attention to your breathing, and even the clinician prescribing what the person should hear or see or feel. I find that boring, personally. And if somebody did that to me, I would start opposing them because I have that kind of personality. It wouldn't work. But if somebody sat down with me and said, notice how you're sitting in the chair. What comes to mind? You can tell me or you can keep it private. And as you do that, begin to notice the parts of that that help you feel more and more comfortable. And imagine that person's already hooked up to those sensors, and we can measure that they are already changing their, what we call, autonomic response, their fight or flight response, turning that down. Then they can see, wow, this is really working for me. So that's how we integrate those things. So it's very much patient, person, child centered, because they're the people who actually have all the skills. So it can look pretty formal or it can look very natural.
Probably the skill of the clinician or the pediatrician in recognizing the best approach for it.
Right. And most, the best part for me is it requires me to be playful.
You enjoy your work and got to get to know them. Yeah.
And then somebody actually pays me, which it's hard to believe.
I'm way overdue for a break here. I didn't even realize that. Here's what I'm going to do. Look at the conversation. I was just locked in here. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, come back, tell you about our pledge drive, and then we're going to hear from some people who have been impacted by this work already. Dr. Lauren Sugarman at RIT is doing some very, very interesting and impactful work already in autism. Stay with us right here on Connections on member-supported public radio.
This is Carla Clare. In democracy, serious journalism is not a luxury. It's a necessity. Accurate, objective reporting gives us the information we need to form an opinion about the issues and events. But serious journalism does not come free. Here at WXXI, we believe that listener-supported reporting is the best way to give you the news. And your monthly membership gift will give WXXI the resources to provide this kind of reporting. Please become a sustaining member at WXXI.org.
And the next 20 minutes are going to fly here with Dr. Sugarman. If you're just joining us here on Connections, Dr. Lauren Sugarman from RIT is working on a method of hypnosis and biofeedback that approaches autism in a bit of a different way, I think it's fair to say. And I want to get to Jen Spencer, who's on the line with us. Jen can tell us about some of your own feedback that you've had in working with Dr. Sugarman. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Evan. How are you? And hi, Dr. Sugarman.
Very good.
Hi, Jen.
I've had a lot of success with Dr. Sugarman's approach so far. I've been going through his program, the Parent Effectiveness Program, through Autism Up, which is a collaboration with RIT. And it's really focusing on changing my behaviors and modeling in such a way that helps bring my son's anxiety down when he's dealing with the different stresses and situations that he is in. I was not granted the gift of patience by any means, so it's given me a chance to take a step back, slow down, and give him the attention, and again, that modeling of the behaviors that I want him to learn and to continue on as he grows.
Jen, how old is your son?
He is 8.
He's 8, and when did you start working with Dr. Sugarman?
Just recently, in the past month.
Okay, and when you come into a process like this, do you have any skepticism or do you have any concerns as a parent, especially because with a child who's now 8, you've seen a lot of different ideas and you've seen a lot out there. What were your thoughts coming into the process?
I was very open and I was very happy to be accepted into the program and to go through this process. Josh was diagnosed at age 3, so we've been dealing with this for quite some time, and we're always open to any type of suggestions and programs and skills to help him and to help us as parents.
Can you weigh in on this particular case?
I just want to thank you, Jen, for participating. And so we haven't talked about this yet, but the Golisano Foundation has funded this collaboration between us and Autism Up, and we'll talk more about that. But this is the question that was posed to us in our center at RIT was, how can you apply this in the community? And it seemed to us that the best way to do that would be to teach parents how to self-regulate their own behavior, especially in anticipation of stress. Transitions were a big problem in families with kids, with any kids, but with kids with autism spectrum disorder. So there's a skill set we're teaching the parents, and includes just what Jen said, taking a step back, paying attention to their own breathing. We do some biofeedback and some mini hypnosis during the parent training sessions, and then talk about it. So this is a model of applying this in a community.
And Jen, it sounds to me like you're going to continue with this.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, we appreciate you weighing in with us, Jen. And Jen and Dr. Sugarman mentioned, and Jen, I'll let you go because I'd like to bring in Sarah Milko here. They mentioned autism up here, so let me switch over and bring in Sarah Milko. She is the executive director of Autism Up. Sarah, are you there?
I am. Hi. How are you today?
Great. I know you've been listening, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us as well. What has been your organization and your own view of this kind of research and this kind of approach?
Well, this has been really exciting for us as an organization. You know, just to kind of take one step back, Autism Up is a local autism support organization, and our mission is really to support individuals with autism and their families by expanding and enhancing opportunities to improve the quality of life, because for so many families, it's a challenging disorder. The exciting thing about this collaboration was the fact that the Golisano Foundation literally connected us as an organization with Dr. Sugarman. You know, the Golisano Foundation was able to look at what Dr. Sugarman was doing at his CAPS program and then look at us and say, hey, this would be a great collaboration. With that, we were given the opportunity through funding from them to present this program to our families. It's a great alternative for families, a different approach, something new, and it's at no cost, which I can't emphasize enough is so important to families who in so many different situations are desperate for information and guidance. And this is really what Dr. Sugarman's been able to give our families, so we're extremely grateful.
Let me ask Sarah and Dr. Sugarman a question. I'll start with you, Dr. Sugarman. It sounds to me like this treatment, biofeedback and hypnosis, is perhaps more effective for children who are, and I've got to be careful with terminology, I'm going to use the term more highly functioning.
Right.
I don't want to.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. So so this new term, well, this agreed upon term, autism spectrum disorder, is divided into low, medium to high functioning. As one of the reasons we're doing this with parents, and I have to add, not only did the Golisano Foundation bring us together, but we're really enjoying playing well together. Sarah and I are siblings now, and and they're such a great organization and a vehicle. I want to also add that this is a study. We're going to have data. At the end of March, we're going to start putting this data together and actually measure what we are and have numbers to go with what parents are telling us. That aside, you know, it's very interesting. You can sit a person who has very little verbal ability or no verbal ability in front of a computer and show them how their body is responding in a graphically compelling way, and they will change. So if you look in a mirror, you get information and you can change. I think it takes clinical skills and training by a developmental behavioral pediatrician or developmentally sensitive psychologist or other mental health care professional to know how to use these skills in a developmentally appropriate way. But our idea, which seems to be working, is that, well, let's start with the parents. They know their kids best. And they know their kids' responses best, and let's have them learn to model, as Jen said, changing behavior. Albert Schweitzer said something like, modeling isn't a form of education. Modeling's the only form of education. So when parents don't react the same way as they used to, but respond mindfully and thoughtfully, their children start doing the same thing.
My son is 22 months old, and my wife and I use the term pro-social modeling, I don't know, every day.
Yes.
Every time I, you know, it's just, it's remarkable. And that, obviously, that doesn't stop. It is the form of education. Now, Sarah Milko, let me ask you, listening to Dr. Sugarman throughout this hour, he is talking about an approach that is more, I'm going to use the word adaptive, or at least malleable to each individual in terms of a slightly different approach. How important is that in addressing autism itself and children with autism?
I think it's really important. I mean, as Dr. Sugarman is saying, this really goes back to learning fundamental self-regulation skills and modeling those skills so our children with autism can base their growth on seeing how their parents react. It's critical to their growth and development, and it makes sense to so many of the families. You know, I have the opportunity to sit in on these sessions and watch, and it's the light bulb moments for these parents, and they come back on a weekly basis and report how this is going with the families and with their children that they're interacting with, and it works. But it goes back to looking at those fundamental self-regulation skills.
Sarah, if people want more information on Autism Up, where do they go?
Best place to go is our website, www.autismup.org, or you can always certainly call our office at 585-248-9011.
Thanks for taking the time to join us during this hour, Sarah. It's been very interesting for all of us. Yeah, thank you, and I'm sure we'll be talking much more. That's Sarah Milko.
Thank you, Sarah.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Sugarman.
You got it. That's Sarah Milko, the Executive Director of Autism Up, and she's talking about the impacts. You're talking about the fact that we're not that far away from starting to see data collected, and then what's next on this?
Well, so I'm going to make a plug, because she mentioned CAPS. So. This at RIT, we have the Center for Applied Psychophysiology and Self-Regulation. What a unwieldy term, which is part of the new College of Health Sciences and Technology. And this is very exciting. And I have to mention, I'm so excited to be at RIT. Our president, Bill Destler, really gets it and has a vision of health promotion and behavioral change through this new college and institute. It's very exciting to be there. So we are doing really three studies right now. The Parent Effectiveness Program is one of them. We have another study where we're looking and recruiting patients, recruiting kids from 8 to 18 years of age with autism spectrum disorder who can talk with us to test out some new biofeedback algorithms. And finally, we have been for 2 years now collecting data on young people at RIT with anxiety and or autism spectrum disorder, and technical universities attract such students, to teach them to self-regulate. The mission of CAPS isn't to help autism. That's just our focus. Our mission is to really change healthcare by focusing on self-regulation to balance out what we do to people. So if we can do that for young people with autism, we make a huge difference, but it also proves our thesis.
Let's get back to the phones. Bernard from Fairport's been waiting to talk to Dr. Sugarman. Go ahead.
Thank you. You just addressed what I was concerned about, is the fact that this shouldn't be limited to autism. Autism is kind of a nominal fallacy in the sense that we don't really, you know, we can't really test for it. So we shouldn't limit this approach, it seems to me, just to autism, though autism may cause more funding. But and the other thing is, I was involved in this kind of a study back in the 60s, and what we came away with in terms of hypnosis was that a lot of people responded to it because there was no reason not to respond to it. So it seems to me there would be a very good way to kind of, if you will, I don't want to call modify, but make provide benefit to people who do demonstrate behaviors that aren't constructive, or however you want to put it.
So right.
I'd be interested in your comments.
Yeah, Bernard, thank you. These are great comments. So, you know, I didn't used to be an autism guy. You need to find a place to put the lever to change the world. And so helping young people with autism, because we really believe and have reason to data to believe that they're condition is fundamentally a problem of regulating that fight or flight response, that if we can help them, we get to prove our point. And yes, there is funding and interest and support for this group. So why not make a difference there? Absolutely. Fundamentally, what we need to change in healthcare, from my point of view and from the point of view of many others, is we have to help people change their own behavior. Hypnosis and biofeedback are fundamental ways to help people change their health behaviors.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you want to read more and share in your own networks about this issue or check out more of what Dr. Sugarman's doing, RIT published their own, essentially their own story, kind of summing up, you know, these technical articles, Dr. Sugarman, can be pretty dense, and that's okay. But RIT did a really nice job of summing it up. I have posted a link on my own Twitter account. If you want to check it out, follow Evan Dawson on Twitter. It's up there before the noon hour today. I posted it so you could see it and join the conversation and see more about it. So we've talked about the next steps. We've talked about, obviously, you've got to observe and you've got to collect more data, and the greater the sample size, the better,
right,
in the medical community. But this does seem to be, even in the early stages, it does seem to be, or at least have the potential, to become a more regular and relied upon approach. And if that happens, is it 5 years? Is it 10 years down the line? Every city in the country that this kind of approach will be there? I mean, is there an end game?
Well, so we're building towards that. So we're testing our biofeedback algorithm in preparation for what we refer to in our center as the big study. And the big study is to have some really good measures. Bernard said autism can't be tested for. Yes, it can. There are some rigorous tests that say you do or you do not have this disorder, though lots of people live on the fringe. So big test to say, okay, here are these measures and biological measures. We can measure stress levels from people's saliva. If they can spit in a test tube, we can measure stuff. So have some really good rigorous measures of saying before and after. Teach a group of kids using a fairly standard but customizable and a flexible protocol for teaching them skills and self-regulation and measuring their changes. So if we can do that in the next year or so, funding willing, then the next step would be to collaborate with other centers around the country and around the world, and we know we have those. But to Bernard's point, and to say, look, we can do this with this group. How do we integrate self-regulation scales into standard healthy medical care? We think if you can start helping people help themselves, we might be able to bend that cost curve of increasing healthcare costs.
Let's get back to the phones. Jenna in Pittsford is on with Dr. Sugarman.
Dr. Sugarman taught us. My son is 13, and Larry was our pediatrician from the time I was pregnant. But when Jackson was diagnosed with Asperger's, Dr. Sugarman taught us a really important phrase, which was, you need tools in a toolbox. And I think the biofeedback is just that. It's one more tool in a toolbox with our children, but more importantly for parents, because nobody gives you an instruction manual when things go wrong. And he handed us a poem when things started going awry, called Welcome to Holland, meaning you're planning this great trip to Tuscany, and all of a sudden you get off the plane and you're in Holland. Things are completely different, unexpected, and not that he doesn't have gifts and things to offer the world, but it's a completely different perspective to learn. And as a parent, you need to learn different ways. And I think the biofeedback, the parent effectiveness training you're doing with Autism Up is an incredible blessing, Dr. Sugarman. So thank you for everything you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Each of these kids is an investment, you know. So keep it
going. And that's a great way to phrase it, because the investment and the success as they grow up and as they continue and are successful as young adults and older adults in life, that is an investment not only in their future but in our society.
Yeah.
Jenna's call, by the way, has me looking up Welcome to Holland. I found it.
Oh, isn't it
I found
great?
It immediately by Emily Pearl Kingsley.
That's right.
I can't read the whole thing, but Jenna.
It's still framed.
you still have it, huh?
Yeah.
I do. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
bye.
Jenna.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's. But I don't have to read the poem to know that the idea is there. You're planning on something, you end up somewhere else. It doesn't mean it's a disaster. It means you may have to adapt to something new.
Yeah, there's you really had your heart set on Italian food, and now you're looking at tulips.
But that's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
That it can be an adjustment. Okay, so we've got a few minutes left with Dr. Lawrence Sugarman from RIT, talking about his approach here, and. You know, we've talked about next steps. Are you getting the support that you guys need to continue this research?
Well,
and you mentioned Galisano and others.
Yeah, we are vigorously looking for funding. This is not mainstream. This is pilot stuff. So that's the good news is it doesn't require a huge amount of money yet. And I have a different career path. I haven't started as an academic medicine researcher early in my career. I've practiced in the community for many years. So that's all of those differences are challenges for us. Whenever I complained of anything, my mother always said, "Let it be a challenge to you," which really annoyed me when I was a child. But now, now her voice is in my head, reminding
me. It builds character.
Exactly. That's another thing I didn't like. So we are going to creatively and vigorously look for funding because we can make a big difference.
What is different, or what have you learned as you get going in this process and you start to get more feedback from families and parents and children? When you got into this, when you developed this method to today, what is different? Nothing ever turns out exactly like you see it in your head. Right. What has surprised you and what have you had to change?
That's a great question. I have to think about it for a moment. Well, I should mention that this isn't exactly what you asked, but I should mention that we have Brian Garrison is our research coordinator at RIT. He's an alum from RIT with a master's in behavioral neuroscience. And I've had to learn how to do research. I've had to learn how to be rigorous. And Anna Hope is our clinical research coordinator, a master's in mental health counseling from St. John Fisher, a wonderful program. And from them, of course, I've learned, is my way of doing things isn't the only way of doing things. So being more flexible is very important. I think there's a great role in trusting families to know their children well. So in the same way we are centered on what the children's resources are, parents have lots of resources, and we help them develop those in this process, help them believe in themselves, become the kind of person that their child wants to emulate. The biggest surprise was that, you know, I developed these skills in listening to parents and being in clinical practice, which means not really testing. It's all anecdotal. So now that I'm finally doing this in a research, more rigorous, more reproducible setting, the biggest surprise is that it is still powerful and really works. I was, like anybody else, willing to find out that, okay, what I've been doing all these years is really stupid and doesn't work. It's very exciting to find out that it is powerful.
But, you know, that's real science, is saying we're open to the evidence, and if the evidence says it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And that's as important as anything. I've got, less than a minute left here, and we're wrapping up with Dr. Lawrence Sugarman of RIT, whose work could certainly change the way we approach autism. He's not here saying that he is changing the world on his own. There's a lot of great research being done in other ways with autism. But how fascinating. And my last question to you is this. From the parents you've worked with, has anybody come in and said, "I don't know, I don't trust hypnosis," and have they walked out feeling differently?
Absolutely, all the time. All the time. Thank you for this opportunity, Evan.
Well, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate you taking the time to do it. And as you get more data and as you progress, we will be glad to have you back to talk more about what's going on here.
This summer.
This summer. You got it. You've just committed yourself, by the way.
Okay.
And,
all right.
Nicole in studio is going to book you for the summer. See you again soon. And thank you for spending the hour with us. A short break here, and then we're coming back with a very different subject. We're looking for ways to make sure young boys and girls, but especially boys, if they get into trouble, how do we make sure they don't end up criminals for life? One of the really good voices in this field joins us in studio next.